So Jesus hasn't really started his ministry yet. And the furthest he's gotten so far is he's gathered he has gathered his disciples. Excuse me. And as we look at the John's narration of this very famous moment in Jesus' life, it's easy to forget that we're dealing with the book of John, which means it's going to be confusing to some extent, because John can be very, very symbolic, and he can also be very concrete and very practical. And as readers, we have to figure out which is which. This is what I mean. He starts this with, on the third day. Okay? What do we mean by that? Is he suggesting something deeper? Or to put it another way, third day of what? Because you could go to, well, Jesus is raised on the third day, or is that after 3 days? Because that's confusing. But then if you look at what happened before this, Jesus has been gathering his disciples, and that's created kind of a couple of weird situations. I mean, for starters, Jesus upended everything. Usually it's, in fact, always, except for this, it's the student who applies to the rabbi. The rabbi does not go looking for disciples. And any good rabbi would look for, like, the academic kids, you know, the smart kids, or young adults. Instead, Jesus has gathered tradesmen, fishermen, that type, which is just odd. And in one case, one goes to his brother and says, "We've found the Messiah. He's from from Nazareth." And he says, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" The answer is no. It's like when I was born, I lived in Pomona, California. Can anything good come from Pomona? No. And if you've been there, you'll know why. It's just kind of like a backwoods, sort of out of, like, just weird area. And yet, then when he says, "Well, come and see," and Jesus has insight into this guy that nobody else could have. And in fact, it's so mysterious that we're not really sure what Jesus means by it. So I think when this narrative starts out on the third day, John is just being practically saying, well, 3 days, you know, on the third day of doing this stuff, he ends up at a wedding. And for some reason, his mom's there. Notice that she's not named. And this will also be the last time she speaks in literature, in writing. For some reason, Mary, mom, is really invested in this wedding, and especially in the reputation of the bridegroom. Why? We're not told. There's some speculation that maybe this is James, one of Jesus' brother's weddings. That's a nice idea, and it makes some things fit, but I wouldn't publish that because there's no way to know. John, for whatever reason, doesn't seem keen on telling us. But regardless, they're at this wedding feast. Wedding feasts in that era would last like several days. Several days of celebration. And so it would be a great shame, like literally shame on the bridegroom if they run out of wine. He was the one responsible for providing it. And for whatever reason, I don't know if he was just bad at this sort of thing like I would be or what, but they run out of wine and this whole celebration is about to be a source of shame for this guy. Now, Mary, for whatever reason, is really invested in this, and so she goes to Jesus and says, "They've run out of wine." And this is like, you know, when your spouse tells you something and you know that they're not just giving you information. Yeah, you know, It's like everybody who's married just went like, it's like, whatever. Office is closed tomorrow. I had a professor at Baylor. I think he just he said this. I think because he thought it was funny, and I think it's hilarious. So I'm always going to bring it up, but don't take it too seriously. It's almost like Mary is saying, "Hey, they ran out of wine. Your invite for your invite to this was for a plus one, not a plus 12. So, and you brought a bunch of fishermen, and we know how they are. So." Now, I wouldn't take that very far. Because John doesn't seem, he's just not interested in filling that gap either. So I bring it up to so we can start feeling how John is playing with details. He fills some in and others he just doesn't give. And we're stuck left wondering why. Anyway, he responds with, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My time has not yet come." And the fact that he calls his mom woman is not chauvinistic. It's way more gentler, way more gentle than that. Maybe akin to like ma'am or something like that. But regardless, Jesus seems pretty clear, like, this is not my problem to solve. And not only that, it's clear that he is making some connection to what is happening in this moment with his time. Like the time for him to emerge publicly, the time for his glorification, the time for God to finally do what he has promised to do, which will be the apex and culmination of the history of Israel. Somehow that's connected. And what's even weirder, and John does this in a couple of places, Jesus says, "This is not my problem." And so then Mary goes to the servants and says, "All right, whatever he tells you to do, do it." He just said no. Yeah, you don't say no. You don't say no to Mary. He did. And I bring this up again just so we can just feel how strange this narrative is. I want it to feel unfamiliar because it's easy to just sort of get lost in its familiarity. So she says to the servants, "Hey, whatever he says, just do that." Meaning she has some kind of authority there. Again, we don't know why. And then John says, "Now there are these six stone jars, like 30 gallons each." That's huge. That's just a lot of liquid. And they're used for mikvah, ritual purification, which for a first century strict observing Jewish person, you would need for many different circumstances, male and female. And if you endured my Leviticus class, you might be able to remember some of those reasons. Poor you. Anyway, Jesus then tells them, "Yeah, go fill those up." That's a big ask. This is like 150 to 180 gallons. So these servants are stuck schlepping to whatever water source they have, carrying back however small, or, you know, the largest they can carry, and it's still going to take a little while. Like, that's a big ask. That's weird. And then Jesus just says, "Okay, go take that to the master of the feast." Now, that's not the bridegroom. The bridegroom just supplies the stuff. And so there sometimes, like, this feels like a overly dramatic internet argument. Like, people will say, "Well, when did it actually become wine?" The correct answer is, it doesn't matter. Stop wasting your time. But by the time the master of the feast tastes it, it is wine, and it's apparently quite good. Then he turns to the bridegroom and honors him. This is an honor-shame culture. It would be immensely shameful for him to run out of wine, but now Jesus has just set it up so that this guy gets major props, major honor within his community, which is vital in a traditional culture like this. And he says, obviously, like, you have a big feast like this, you start with the good wine and then you work your way down as, shall we say, people become less discerning. And then he says, but you have saved the best for last. And then John starts to give us a little insight into what's going on here. The only group, the only people that know what's going on are the servants and Jesus' disciples. Now I'm going to take two like divergent paths here, which is, so I've got kind of two points to make, which is pastor speak for, I couldn't decide which one, so I'm going to do both. The first is that Jesus is intent and content on bringing honor to somebody and not taking any credit for it. It's kind of a surface level sort of observation. And I think that's really worth noticing. Now, it's purely a coincidence that I say this on the day that TikTok gets banned. And if you don't know what that is, you are called blessed. Although I just heard that it's open back up, whatever, I don't care. We're kind of in this cultural moment that really seems to put a lot of tension and give a lot of like credibility to those who are good at tooting their own horns. And social media has just thrown gas on this fire if it didn't just cause it to begin with. And it's common to curate a public image of yourself that just shows the best of you. And not only that, but depending on what kind of image you're trying to create, it shows you doing the good things, the best things, and taking all the honor and glory. So people will pretty regularly like put videos of themselves online, like feeding homeless people. Like, please just put that down and feed the people who need it. What is this need for external validation? What is this need to claim the glory for ourselves? I think that's deeply unhealthy. Now, at the same time, there are moments where this is just important for communication. Like, we as a church and a school have an obligation to inform you of things that we are doing. Some of this is for the sake of accountability. Again, we have a mission out in the international district. There are some other things we do. We have very selflessly raised a bunch of money to help with the scholarship fund for families who want a private Christian education but can't afford it. Like, these are good things, and we have to communicate them. Not only for accountability, but also to as an invitation to bring others along. But regardless, Jesus' contentment with just sitting back and flying under the radar and doing something immensely helpful for not just everyone, but especially for this mysterious bridegroom, I think should speak to our tendency to advertise ourselves. So that's one point. The second point is a lot deeper. And it's going to take us in a few directions. The first is starting with the question of what do we do with this story in general? Does it just mean Jesus likes to party or something like that? Because it's clear that the miracle itself is not the point, but the point doesn't readily make itself known. Now, for starters, John ends with, and the only people who knew were the servants and the disciples. There's some significance there, because if you go back to chapter 1 in John, you realize these disciples have only known Jesus for maybe a couple of days. Like, this is a very recent thing. So even if they have this nagging sense that Jesus is not just your standard teacher, there's something else going on here, they don't know much. But at the end of this story, now they do. They know a little more. They know more than most everybody else at the feast. What, like, he just... So it's impossible not to go there and wonder how the disciples squared that away. Like, he just did that. What have we gotten ourselves into? What did he get us into? What's going on here? And as the story is narrated, I think Jesus seems very content in not explaining that. And I appreciate that. However, there's more that we can say. At the end of the reading from Isaiah, there's language about a bridegroom. And God will sometimes refer to himself through the prophets as kind of the bridegroom, and Israel is his bride. And one of the very important ways that Jesus will talk about himself within, like, the entirety of the New Testament, and other people will talk about him as well, is that Jesus is the bridegroom of the church. So, gentlemen, you are the bride of Christ. And women, you are the sons of God. And this is where it seems like John is making some statements that probably deserve a little more attention. And I think maybe this explains why the bridegroom just goes unnamed. Because if Jesus takes on this role of bridegroom that has huge echoes into the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, it's what Israel is meant to, or Israel is meant to be the bride. God is meant to be her bridegroom. And as Jesus then takes his ministry and he goes public and his hour does come, it's very clear that one of the things Jesus does is he takes on that identity of Israel. He fulfills the what Israel was supposed to do as God's people, but he also is courting God's people. He will refer to himself in parables and other gospels as the bridegroom come to collect his bride, his people. And John, as he's telling this narrative about Jesus in chapter 1, because this is chapter 2, in chapter 1, in the explosive opening paragraphs, he relates Jesus to creation, and it's all very, very rich and full. And he also starts weaving in the story of Moses. Like, God sent Moses, his great prophet, through whom God gave Torah, his gift to his people, his law, his teaching, however you want to say it. And this was all good. And Israel struggled to live up to that. And in spite of that struggle, we would be thinking, as John's telling the story, that Israel struggled, but God was always faithful to his bride. God is the bridegroom. And as John makes this identification that Jesus is God walking around in the flesh, that the bridegroom has come to collect his bride. And all of the things that God has done leading up to this moment were good. And Jesus has been saved for last. This is where I think the master of the feast, as he's saying what he's saying, is potentially very clearly talking about Jesus. Potentially very clearly. I think it's very likely. He's talking about Jesus. I'll give you an illustration. My uncle is a wine collector, wine connoisseur of kind of the highest, pretty high caliber. We've been to very, very fancy restaurants, the kind that wouldn't normally let people like me in. But I was with him, so it was cool. And he ordered wine for the table. And he looked at the list, knew what he wanted, recognized it, and whatever. And then the sommelier just showed up at the table and said, "Who ordered that?" Recognizing, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. And they set up, this was when I was living in on the San Francisco Peninsula, somewhere around 2010. They set up a big tasting event that they hosted in their home. And it was, there were some really interesting, cool people. There was like a judge for the county and some other people. And then there was me and Katie and our friends who are our age. They didn't relegate us to the kiddie table, which I appreciate. And it was a wine tasting and pairing event that he orchestrated because he just loves to do this. And it was, sounds very pompous, it was a Stag's Leap vertical. So it was sampling and tasting wines from the Stag's Leap district of Napa Valley. And if you know wine, you know that's just about the best that they offer. Just incredible, incredible wines. And they had different years produced in the same soil, so you could kind of taste some of the differences from some of the different wineries. It was really, really a neat experience. Just you just felt a little more connected to the soil and to the earth, because you, as those wines changed, you could tell it was because the year, the conditions were different. And it was paired with food that sort of brought out different flavors in each. They brought out the best in each other. It was just a neat experience. Now, I will say, as that night progressed, you definitely got less discerning. Just is what it is. And he got up and he led discussion about each of the wines because, you know, everyone's palate is different, and someone would describe it in a way that you hadn't, and then you try it again and it actually changed. You can taste some of those notes that you couldn't before. It was just a really neat experience. And then dessert came. I don't remember what dessert was, because the thing he brought out sort of dwarfed everything else. He said, "We have one final wine. It's a Madeira, Portuguese Madeira, so it's a fortified sweeter wine. Let me tell you a little bit about it before I unveil it. When the grapes went in the cask, Reagan had not yet been president." You think, ooh, wow, okay. "In fact," he said, "Lincoln had not yet been president. The grapes went into the cask in 1850. The Madeira went into the bottle in the 1970s. It was unforgettable. It just exploded in your mouth. You'd pour about that much. That's all you need. That's all you want. Like, it was so rich, and it was such an experience. Because you're tasting this history, but you're also tasting flavors that you can't reproduce unless the grapes go in the cask in 1850. In other words, as we went through this dinner and we sampled these amazing wines from one of the areas of the world that produce the best wine, what we didn't know at the time was that the best was yet to come." Now back to Jesus. As he is behind the scenes honoring the bridegroom. And there's, I think our attention has to be drawn to that. And then to the master of the feast who says to the bridegroom, normally we bring the good stuff out first, and then as people get less discerning, shall we say, then you bring out the $2 chuck or $3 or however much it is these days. And it's fine, but you have saved the best for last. I think John is not so subtly suggesting that as God has been with his people over the centuries and given them the gift of his presence, the gift of his word, that has all been good. But it has not been the best. And the best is now here. To quote Jonathan Edwards, the famous Puritan preacher and writer, with Jesus, the best is always yet to come. And so thinking about those disciples who in that moment, that evening, were probably going, who did we just sign up with? This is not a typical rabbi. Something is happening here. Then years later, or as John is writing this all out, after years of prayer and reflection, thinking, little did we know that the one who transformed water into good wine, for whom the best is always yet to come, will become the wine that is poured out as his blood. That in a move that nobody saw coming, God has waited to reveal the best for last. That God will give himself for his people, and it ends up not just being for Israel, but for all of humanity. And now we, as his people, have lived in that reality for 2,000 years. The reality that he is the one who poured out his blood, which is the wine, that pouring out of his blood is a sacrifice for our sins, makes us right with God. And yet, God has not finished what he started with Jesus. The Apostle Paul will go on to remind us that God will do for us what he did for Jesus on that last day when all of creation breathes a sigh of relief and all things are finally redeemed, which means it's still true. With Jesus, the best is still yet to come. Amen.